Welcome back to A Chill Rondo. My name is Paula Tuttle, and this week I'm joined by three musicians, Katie Kresik, Barbara Pagurski, and Colin Pip Dixon. They're starting a music festival in southern France this summer. It's called the Krakauer Institute for Intensive Summer Study. Katie Kresik was a recent guest on A Chill Rondo. She talked to us about the concertmaster role she premiered in the Broadway hit Moulin Rouge. And we also talked about the Tony Award she received for her role as the orchestrator on the same Broadway show. Well, she's here with Barbara Pagurski, a pianist also living in New York, who performed globally with notable violinists, cellists, and instrumentalists. She runs a nonprofit organization that presents concerts in Queens, New York. It's called Music Regine. Our third guest is Colin Dixon, a violinist from Eugene, Oregon, and he has a theater company called the Elsewhere Ensemble. They perform theater and classical music in crossover events. Katie, Colin, and Barbara all have deep connections with the late Barbara Krakauer. They studied with her, and then all three became teaching assistants. And now they're bringing a new festival in her name, which actually hopes to recreate the one she started in the 1990s. Colin, I believe you started taking violin with Mrs. Krakauer at age 8. Is that right?
I was studying with another teacher for a year, and I used to come home with headaches. And my mother asked if there wasn't another teacher. This was at the Manis Prep. And I was introduced to Barbara, and right away it was just wonderful. I studied with her regularly from 8 until 18, until I went away to college. I would always come back and have lessons with her. And then later on, along with Katie and another student of hers, we were her assistants.
When did you first go to the stage?
When I was 18. So I had heard about it for many years as a teenager. There was a lot of anticipation about knowing about it and preparation. And the funny thing is, or not so funny, but the first year I went, there was a gust of wind like the second or third day there, and it slammed a door on my finger. And so that first stage, I spent most of my time actually with Barbara's husband, Bill. He drove me around the countryside and showed me Aix-en-Provence. It was a small fracture, but I was able to play at the end of the stage with, we cut out any passages that went too high up on the E string so it wouldn't be too painful.
So let's hear from Katie. What were your first experiences with Barbara Krakauer?
I also worked with Barbara as a young violinist, and I met her when I was in pre-college. And at the time, I had a long list of teachers who were very insistent about their way. Like Colin was saying, I kind of would go away either crying or with headaches. And I had a friend at Manis pre-college at the time who never seemed to have that experience. You know, she was always talking about how she would come out of her lessons smiling and had this sense of joy and love about what she was working on. And I was impressed, you know, and I just thought, I was like, who is your teacher? You know, and she said, well, you should meet her. Her name is Barbara Krakauer, and we're going to France this summer, and why don't you have a lesson? So I went and took a lesson with her at her apartment on 85th Street that was just down the street from Manis at the time. I remember just going into my first lesson, and I was greeted with this smile, this, you know, radiant face of somebody who exuded enthusiasm and love and appreciation for everything that was going on in the room. The fact that we'd both made the time to be there. There was repertoire on the table that was interesting and beautiful and colorful to talk about. And, you know, I played through what I was doing. I think a lot of us assume crash position, you know, after playing for a new teacher for the first time. And I just didn't feel like that in this situation. You know, she smiled after I played and she said, wow, you really do this well. You know, and she just started out that lesson with working from strengths. And I was so taken aback. You know, it was like that saying, you had me at hello. You know, it was just like, I just felt so completely comfortable and at ease in her presence. And I just knew that this was where I needed to be. And we talked about France, and she said, come, you know. And that first stage I went to was with my friend Chelsea Switzer, who is now working with us on this new stage. She's the person who introduced me to Barbara, and she and I were roommates that first summer in Saint-Maximin. You know, I just fell in love love with both France, the violin with Mrs. Krakauer and Bill and all my colleagues that summer. It was an escape for me from everything I kind of knew at home. That sense of just getting away from the things that normally might pull your focus at home.
That's a great picture, Katie. Hey, let's get Barbara into the mix here. Barbara, tell us about your first meeting with Barbara Krakauer.
You know, At Manus, I was studying with Barbara Krakauer's son, David, who was a very well-known clarinetist. For the first couple of years, I had clarinet chamber music. Historically, for many, many years, even in Manhattan School pre-college, I played chamber music, but I very, very rarely would play with the soloist other than a singer. Like, I never really just worked with a violinist. And I don't know, I'm thinking this is how it happened, but I believe then that David introduced me to his mom, that there was some need for a studio accompanist. She actually didn't like so much to use the word accompanist as partner. And I do believe I started working for her on Saturdays. It was my first job, really, for a very little bit per hour. But, you know, I learned so much about being an artist and playing with other musicians, how to become a good listener. And in turn, it's actually what I wound up doing with my life other than teaching. Barbara was one of the most influential people in my life. Little did I know I was going to meet her, you know, when I was 20 years old.
So Barbara, let's talk about your first stage in France. What are your memories of that first time?
Yeah, I think 1997 was my first year. So I was invited to go to France. I was working there. I wasn't there so much for play, although we did get to. I played with lots of people, mostly their lessons and some recitals. I even at some point did some four hands piano with our colleague Rolando Garza Rodriguez, who's now a big conductor. And I believe I went for at least three summers.
So you were there with Alicia. Yes, so we all, the three of us met because we had, at the stage, there was one triple room available.
Oh, yes.
And they decided that the three college girls should room together. So it was me and Barbara and Alicia. And the three of us all bonded that summer.
By the time we left the stage that year, I swear to you, I felt like I knew Katie my whole life when... In fact, I met her as our third roommate. But the way that the stage was set up in this beautiful, beautiful country setting with very little to do other than immerse yourself in music and friendship and just storytelling and eating and making music. Like, I really honestly felt like I knew Katie and some others for a very long time when in fact it was only probably a month that we had known each other. But it really felt like many years by the time we had left.
Let's talk about where the stage is. Let's draw a picture of this beautiful place in Provence.
You know, in Provence, it's such a beautiful place, especially in the summers, because it sort of comes alive with sunflowers and lavender and olive trees, orchards of like beautiful stone fruit. It's like exactly like the Impressionist paintings that, you know, we all kind of know and love. And when I first got there and kind of got off the TGV, I remember just taking in the, you know, smells and the sun, just feeling like it was this otherworldly thing. You know, that setting of it being tranquil and calm and you're away from the hustle and bustle of the city, and also just slower pace. From what I've been told and what I feel like I've observed over the years, it's also that Provence kind of has just a slower pace of life. You know, even the way the French speak in the South is a bit slower than in Paris, for example. I mean, I remember some of the students there were trying to teach us French. You know, they would say, oh, well, the reason you can understand things here in the South is because people don't speak as quickly as they do in Paris. And I remember appreciating that.
You know, there's this market that happens every week. It's been going on for 400 years. And I remember talking to people that, you know, you buy these brightly colored things, and then they would go to Paris and they would say they were too bright.
I feel like the marché used to happen on, was, Katie, was it Wednesday and Saturday?
I think there's like a Tuesday or a Wednesday or something like that. Yeah. Every town, almost every town seems to have its own market day. Mm-hmm. This might be a good chance to pass it to Colin now.
The marché historian.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think everything that you said, Katie, about Provence, it was really just rang so true for me. And it's true that the stage, I think, was always in Provence. It was in different places earlier. Barbara, she was invited by another teacher, French teacher, who's actually Italian origin, Aurelia Spadro. And so she would teach there alongside with Aurelia. But I had the same feeling when I went there. And I think Barbara had such an incredible love of French culture. And I had that sense that she passed that love of French culture, of Provence, to me, to such a point that I actually ended up going to study in France and lived there for 14 years after that. So yeah, these marchés, these markets are wonderful. And, you know, every town has their marché. And even in different neighborhoods in Paris, once a week there's a market and you have all the local produce that's being sold there and all sorts of other things too.
There were linens and things for your table if you wanted to get something for oil and vinegar or a base. The grinders
right.
for your pepper, you know, uh-huh. made out of olive
yep.
wood.
Yeah. Beautiful olive wood, yeah. I think also the cheeses, the regional products of Provence, the honeys, the oils, olives, the produce, just all of that is sort of this extra kind of like beautiful ornamentation to the experience of being there. The place that we have planned for the summer of 2024 is the same location Barbara Krakauer last taught in the 1990s. So after that original summer that I went in 94 in Saint-Maximin, she then partnered up with her longtime collaborator, Janine Dawis, the pianist, and they began their own festival in this town, Vaison-la-Romaine. But it means like Roman view, right? Like a view of the Romans or something like that? Or is that what Vaison
means? Yeah. I don't know what Vaison means. But
or
yeah.
Vision?
I think it's like, vision, yeah. Like
vision
Roman
of the
vision.
Roman is...
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of it as a vista or a view. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just north of Avignon in Aix-en-Provence. You sort of feel like you're going up into the hills a bit. Not quite the mountains yet, but there's a medieval city. And then there's also a section that's filled with Roman ruins, like it's spectacular Roman ruins. And there's a huge amphitheater there that has a concert series with the likes of Mavis Staples was there last summer when I was visiting. And real legends come and perform in this space. It's absolutely monstrous. It's huge. The location that we'll be staying used to be called the Centre Acourgeois. Now it's called the Centre Moulin, which means like windmill. It's Moulin de César, actually. So it's César's windmill. You know, just as it was, the rooms are the same. They've added a swimming pool. They've added...
I'm very excited about the swimming pool.
Yeah.
it can get warm there. It can get warm.
Yeah, they've added fire pits, kind of more like a campground. They've added a lot of nice touches from when we were there. But back when we were there, the space itself really lent itself to community. You know, our rooms were all right next to each other. And then there were practice rooms on the first floor. They have 5 rooms featuring pianos, you know, with their own pianos. There's a large communal room with a grand piano where workshops and master classes and even concerts take place. And then, you know, there's communal eating. They've even added a bar space, which is lovely. So, you know, it has like sort of all the makings of a retreat, you know, the kind of setup where people can work together, they can play together, they can relax together. I think it sort of hits all the right notes, no pun intended.
Yeah, I remember you can walk to restaurants and shops too. It's not like you're completely secluded. You're
right.
Immersed in the culture. They even enforce the siesta. What do they call it?
Siesta.
Also a restorative element of the stage. And incorporating that siesta into our day seemed to actually help. You then have a new burst of energy at 4:00.
I remember having learned this respect of quiet when Barbara Krakauer would kind of shush us if we were talking just a little bit. You know, if we weren't going to sleep, that was fine, but we had to be very, very quiet for 2 hours, which kind of was lovely, actually.
Yeah, I really appreciate, Paula, that you used 2 words that I think I really associate with this endeavor, which is restorative and healing. But then there's also the idea of what Colin was explaining a stage can be, you know, 22 years after Barbara Krakauer's passing. You know, we're hoping to bring back those elements in a way that makes them available to a new generation of students so that it affords to them the opportunities that we were so lucky to have. I think we want to make this available and really pass on her love of music and her love of learning in the ways that she felt were important, you know, the values that she expressed to us, also with elements of the things that make each of us unique in our own careers now, because we've all gone on to work in various ways. You know, for myself, I teach a lot of teachers, and so I often see that especially music teachers tend to experience a specific type of burnout when they're working very hard during the year to give everything they have to their own students. You know, sometimes their relationship to their personal artistry can take a back seat to that. And so thinking about how we can reinvigorate that is important. I know Barbara P. works so hard as a collaborator all year. And, you know, that's a very specific skill that she's going to be bringing to her students this summer, and also to help teach the string players about what it means to work with a pianist. You know, I think there's just so many things that our different backgrounds are going to hopefully make available to a new generation of stagiaires.
What would a typical day look like? How much time do you have alone? How much time are you spending with a teacher one-on-one? How much time you're spending collaborating with colleagues?
What we're sort of modeling this after is stages that we attended when we were younger. We are having a morning yoga class, morning Feldenkrais classes, lessons be available on a daily basis alongside opportunities for ensemble and collaboration, and then also opportunities for classes in theory, arranging, which is sort of my area, composition, which is Colin's area, also ensemble. And then after lunch, you know, the siesta, I think we want to respect that so that there's a quiet time. One of my teachers has always said to me that rest is the basis for action. So I think having a break in the middle of the day where you focus on how you want to set an intention for the afternoon and the evening. After siesta is over, lessons will then resume with more opportunities for ensemble, you know, opportunities for physical recreation. Maybe there's more yoga class or more movement classes. There's communal dinner. And then in the evening, we're looking at recitals, more master classes, things that are thematic in terms of string pedagogy and piano pedagogy, certain types of pedagogical texts like Yost and Sevcik, bowing technique. There will also be opportunities that are specific to, you know, one instrument or another.
Colin, I understand that one of your major missions in life is teaching Feldenkrais, and you're bringing it to the stage. Let's hear a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. Feldenkrais for me was a kind of revolution in my own experience as a violinist. The first time I took Feldenkrais was in France when I was studying there, and after doing a whole day of Feldenkrais, I took my instrument and played again, and there were all these things that were working in ways that I hadn't imagined before. Little by little, I became more and more interested in it and ended up doing the professional training myself. So for those of you who don't know what Feldenkrais is, it's a means of becoming more aware of your body and how you move and how you use it. It can be applied to anything, but I've been really focused on working with musicians. I remember when I was a kid and Barbara telling me, you know, you're lifting your shoulder on your bow arm, and she would tell me again and again, and I didn't know I was doing it and I didn't know how to stop it. It helps with performance anxiety. It helps with becoming more free musically, being able to adapt to all sorts of situations. These are all things that I think are so important to playing that often in lessons we don't have time to work on because we're so busy with repertoire. So one of the things I'll be bringing to the stage is I'll be giving Feldenkrais lessons, and I want to also bring some students along who would be interested in doing intensive Feldenkrais and instrument work together.
Yeah, where are we going to find these students? It's for violin, viola, piano, cello. Is that right?
The original stages were very specific to violin and piano. And there were times when they would be opened up for cellists. We're hoping that we can offer that. It's just something that is still in process for us at this point. So, you know, we should have confirmation of that in a few weeks. You know, in terms of our enrollment, we're expecting, of course, to bring our own students from the United States that currently study with us. I have a large studio in Brooklyn and also at Columbia University.
Colin, are you bringing violinists as well?
So over the years, I've taught a lot of violin, but in the recent years, I have focused on actually teaching Feldenkrais for musicians. I teach a class weekly online. I've taught at ASTA, the American String Teachers Association, national conferences many times. I currently don't have an active violin studio, but I'm definitely open to anybody that would be interested in working with that aspect of playing with me, and of course any of the people that worked with me and work with me currently too.
Well, you're definitely going to have all my students coming to you for this help, because it's something that, you know, I can't give to them, which I'm so happy that you can. You know, it's so valuable. I took one semester of Feldenkrais in my undergrad and found that it made dramatic changes for me permanently. You know, it was really, really great.
It's wonderful, yeah.
Barbara, are you bringing students to this Dodge?
So I have a few very accomplished adult students at the moment. You know, this is not their career, but they're pretty advanced. This year, I think we're keeping it to a little bit older age group, but also opening it up to, you know, not just solo pianists, but people that are concentrating on being collaborative pianists and coming to learn from me about the art of playing with other instrumentalists and also chamber music, and of course, music theory. I know you guys mentioned a music theory class. We don't want to scare anybody. We know that the first year now, you know, we'll have all different levels of people coming. So, you know, we're not going to have all kinds of different theory classes, but, you know, we could have some kind of roundtable discussion and fundamental underlying concepts of how music functions and works, you know, working a little bit on ear training and music theory. Me recommending, you know, stuff for further reading throughout the year, you know, for when you have nothing going on. You know, just how to use your knowledge of music theory to be a better performer and a better artist. How to use it to your advantage.
Yeah, I think that is so valuable, Barbara, if I can just jump in here. I mean,
of course.
As, you know, one of, I've been teaching a studio composition class for undergraduates for quite some time, and in that time, one of the things I hear over and over again is when my students are first taking when they're taking their first steps into arranging and orchestrating, they often tell me that they don't see the theory connections as explicitly as I would imagine. And I think part of an endeavor like this is to help connect those dots. You know, to help people understand how studying theory is really about understanding where you fit in a chord, or where, when you're playing with other musicians, what those voicings mean, where they might go, and what certain chords are associated with in terms of interpretive issues, but also in terms of your own arrangements. You know, I mean, part of, I think, a huge revolution in my own life as a musician was when I started writing arrangements for strings. And I think that, you know, having the theoretical background to be able to do that was a really important link. Sometimes my students will talk about feeling disconnected in that way, and we really make it a priority to help connect those dots and bring that together for them so that they understand a bigger sense of the whole picture. And I think also just on the point of this being a first year, you know, we are keeping it to 18 and over right now. That is something that we may explore later on as things develop. But right now, that is the cutoff point for admission. And the other thing is that we are not holding auditions. Anyone is welcome to register for this. I think it should be stated, we're not looking to create any sort of competitive environment. We want people to feel as though this is a place where everyone is welcome, where they are going to experience a really good balance between individual and community. If somebody has a goal that they want to work on, whether it is looking at combating stage fright, or maybe it's about getting more comfortable in the positions, maybe it's about learning a specific piece, just having the opportunity to stand up in front of others and play on a daily basis. I mean, oftentimes I think playing an instrument can be a lonely thing when you practice.
Yes.
And a lot of times I think, you know, we see this in studies that students, it's not that they don't want to practice, it's that they really don't know how. You know, it's that they haven't thought about how to scaffold and structure that time. I think, you know, we felt a fundamental shift in what it meant to take a lesson, you know, in what it meant to study, and what it meant to work. You know, at any point, all you need to to come to this is, you know, a commitment and a love of music and a desire to work on something. And that is what we're here for.
I think part of the beauty of what this stage is that it's always been a very customizable experience.
Yeah.
Everyone is coming there with different needs and wants and dreams and hopes and different levels. It's just very inspirational to hear all the different levels of people practicing next door, this kind of busy buzzing about when it's not siesta time.
Yeah.
Also being like, can I play this for you before my lesson?
Yeah.
And just everyone kind of just coming together, the older students who are more seasoned, you know, looking at the younger ones and just being inspired by their enthusiasm and excitement. We all kind of fed off of each other's energy. You were there learning at your own pace and had your own goals. And that was part of the beauty of being able to study in this very inspirational environment, the people and the energy. I think about it, I'm not lying, every day of my life since I've been there, there's not one day that's gone by that I haven't thought about my time there, even though it seems so long ago. And I'm so excited to go back next year.
There's this amazing sense that we're all on the same page all these years later, and that connection with Barbara Krakauer has really influenced all three of us in our way of looking at music. I think of Barbara Krakauer's one thing she would say to me was, you know, the violin's so difficult, the only person you should ever be in competition with is yourself. For me, the thing that as the years go on, I realize how unique she was in so many ways, because she had these extremely high standards, and sometimes, you know, it was hard to live up to those standards, but that was combined with incredible humanity and compassion and kindness. The meeting of those qualities feels so rare. I also think that the experience of doing something that you love in another culture, for me, over and over again, has just been so transformative, because it has allowed me to meet that culture in a way that's just so different from being a tourist or just traveling for leisure. It creates these opportunities to meet people locally in ways that you wouldn't, and music is one of those things that can be a language that goes across cultures and barriers.
So you speak French fluently. Will there be any French-speaking students at the stage?
Yeah, I do speak French fluently, and we'll see.
The deadline is not till March, so we have a while to see who will attend.
I have to say one thing that, you know, I feel like Barbara's with us in our little chat right now, because I have this thing that I always say literally almost every day to a student. Colin said that Barbara always said your biggest competition is yourself. And I say this every day, and I never knew exactly who it came from. It's always been in my head, and I realize now I'm a little teary-eyed. Like, I realized it was Barbara Krakauer. And and it's such a great life lesson for the children that I teach and for the grown-up humans that I teach, because, you know, we're so used to getting scores and, like, gold medals and trophies. And then there's your music teacher saying, your biggest competition is yourself, and always try to be better than you were yesterday. And that's just such an important life lesson, not just a musical lesson, that Barbara's left with us.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we might talk about her life just for a moment. You know, I'm so obsessed with this, you know, Bradley Cooper Bernstein movie that's coming out, The Maestro, and I was thinking about how, you know, when, you know, Barbara was a phenomenal violinist. She was born in Brooklyn. I think she went really far at a young age. You know, she played under Bernstein as concertmaster at Tanglewood. You know, she stopped playing for quite some time and had to rediscover the violin, not rediscover, but like return to it after quite a long hiatus. And she actually ended up giving her New York debut when she was 57. You know, that story of her stopping and having to reboot in a way, I think we can all kind of see ourselves in that. You know, this idea where sometimes you have like a, you know, a crisis, you know. And another thing, we haven't said this, but, you know, she passed away from complications due to breast cancer. I believe she was 69. This was in 2001. And, you know, and she should have been with us another 20, 30 years, you know. And when I think about the way that she taught and persevered through her battle with cancer and how resilient she was. Like, you just could not keep her down. Colin and I were, and Barbara were all her assistants on those Saturdays when she would teach, and she had us there not just to mentor us as young teachers, but to take over for her if she was ill from chemo, if she needed a moment, if she needed a day, you know, whatever she needed. And she had us there to not break continuity for the kids. When I think about the ways that she influenced my life, I cannot count them.
At 4 years old, I believe she was studying with Galamian, the violin teacher, and was on this path of high-level violin playing. But from what I understand, she also received a lot of mixed messages as a woman that, you know, you got to be really good at violin, but in the end, you're going to get married and have a family. And I think it's when she had her children, then she did stop for, I think, at least 15 years and then went back to it and said it was one of the hardest things, or it was the hardest thing she ever did in her life, going back. But that created an incredible compassion and understanding for what students, all the difficulties that we go through. And then she rebuilt everything, which was amazing. And she went and took lessons with Dorothy DeLay, the great teacher at that point. And I think really knew then why she was playing. It's true that those years when we were her assistants and she was battling cancer, I rarely took over for her, actually. She was she was always there. And the couple of times I did, she would go and lie down and she would call out things from the bedroom. So, I mean,
that
was a lesson, you know, as Katie said, way beyond the violin.
Yeah, Colin, I think I took over for her once.
It reminds me also that Barbara was very empathetic because she was always looking at her students and seeing how they felt. But she told me her story and she said, I quit playing the violin for 10 years and I was dumb to do that. Those were the words she used. You know, she said, and then I started 10 years later and it was really hard. So I think that all those things add up to her just being so caring and intuitive about what's going on with people. I don't think we've actually announced the exact dates of the stage.
The stage right now, from the 22nd of June to the 30th of June, so kind of like 9 days. We may decide to expand that by 1 or 2 days. We're still solidifying those final dates, right? And it's an interesting time in Provence because the schools are still in session there, so it's a bit quieter than it would be. The summer starts to really pick up there in July, so this will be a nice quiet time. I was there last summer to scout the locations and look at everything, and I was there during that week. In terms of financial aid, that'll be assessed on a individual basis. We'll be launching a website in the next 2 weeks, which is very exciting. Another thing that is really great to talk about is an alumni network that we're establishing. So we've just gotten this off the ground. We're sending out a questionnaire to anyone we know who studied with her because we're asking people to share their memories. You know, we'd like to really reunite folks and have a centralized place where they can share stories.
Tell us the name of your website so people can apply.
Yes, it is krakauerinstitute.com. It has not gone live yet. I think we're looking at a week or two before it launches. And our aim is that January 1st is when it will be out. And then the deadlines will be announced. There'll be email blasts. And, you know, we have our sort of homegrown interest from our own studios. We're limiting it to 20 people for the first summer. And most of those spots are almost already full. There are a few spots left.
You want to talk about your fundraiser? You have a fundraiser on GoFundMe.
That's right, we do. We are hoping to be able to support, you know, some scholarships for participants for this first year, as well as some general operating costs. That website, unfortunately, I can't rattle off because it's like, you know, got tons of numbers associated with it. However, it's also, it's on my personal website, which is katiekresickmusic.com. It's also on a public Facebook page, and it's also on my Instagrams. And if you go on GoFundMe and enter Krakauer Institute, it would be easily found that way. So currently, yes, we are 2/3 of the way to our goal right now, which is wonderful. We're hoping to be able to support more specifically named scholarships as time goes on. We do have one person who's interested specifically in funding participants who are women who are looking to return to the instrument after a long time. So that's an exciting kind of parallel to Barbara's life that we're working on. Just fundraising for this has also been an incredible chance to see her students come out to share their memories and stories of their time with her.
Any special shout outs? What about David Krakauer? He's going to be part of your festival, isn't he?
He is hoping that he will be able to be there to do a master class and be there for possibly a day or two. Right now, his role is as the artistic advisor, but he was absolutely instrumental in coming up with the real plan for this. We met around Labor Day, all of us together here in New York City, and we share everything that we do with him, and, you know, we have his blessing to go forward in this way. He's really been kind of a muse for the festival in sharing the memories of his mother. Also because he's such a tremendous artist in his own right. His musicality and his personal sense of integrity and artistry and individuality is a real kind of guiding light for us. And it's also just a real testament to the way, obviously, he was raised. So,
I know, and I love that you say you have his blessing, because I feel like you have Barbara's blessing by extension.
Yeah, I hope so. I feel that we do. It really is somebody else's legacy. There's a delicate aspect to that in that you don't want to overstep. You don't want to make assumptions. You want to show love and gratitude. You know, anyone can start a stage at any time. We could have just done this. But I think what was important to us was about keeping her legacy vibrantly alive in it.
The three of you recreating this stage is a testament to what you got out of it and the memory of Barbara. It's just a wonderful thing you're doing.
I want to thank my three guests, Katie Kresik, Barbara Podgursky, and Colin Dixon. If you wish to donate, you can go to the GoFundMe site for Barbara Krakauer Institute for Intensive Summer Study. I'm sure it's tax deductible. And I'll put a link in the show notes at accelerandocast.com. I want to mention one last time, the website that will go live in a couple of weeks is thekrakauerinstitute.com. If you like this episode, I hope you'll share it with someone you think will appreciate it. You can subscribe to Accelerando on Apple, Google, Spotify, and Amazon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.